From deep in the wilds of Pittsfield Township, Michigan, it's the Grace and Paul Podcast. She's a left-wing conservative Catholic homeschooler who loves to garden. He's a bearded computer geek who reads and writes like he's running out of time. Together, they're raising an ever-growing army of adorkable children and planning the revolution.
So, friends, Romans, countrymen, comrades, we're here today. We have a special guest, my friend Joy Pryor, Grand Rapids resident, but she's from Hamtramck. Am I right?
Highland Park.
Highland Park. Oh, good grief. See, now I know it's a thing when you confuse Hamtramck with Highland Park because they are not
the same.
Yeah,
they're sort of joined at the hip, literally.
Literally, yeah.
But quite different.
Quite different, different places. I think, Is it Hamtramck or Highland Park that is a separate municipality inside of?
Both of them are.
Oh, okay. And they have their own infrastructure and municipal budgets and things that are separate and distinct from Detroit. But I think they're both surrounded entirely by Detroit.
Yes, that's correct.
I see. And tell me a little bit about the history of that. Like, where did that come from?
I'm not entirely certain, but... Mm-hmm. As many large metropolitan areas, it grew by incorporating unincorporated areas around it. I think what I heard about Highland Park, Henry Ford, the Model T plant was there, and it benefited the powers that be to control the municipality that they were right in.
Right, right.
So they declined incorporation.
I see. And Detroit just expanded around them.
Correct.
Oh, sort of like a company town thing, really.
Somewhat.
Somewhat, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
People think of Dearborn more as being Ford because
later
when they built the Rouge plant, so much was there. And to give people that have a little sense of Detroit from the Eminem movie that was named 8 Mile.
Yeah.
So 8 Mile being the dividing line between Detroit and Oakland and Macomb counties.
Yeah.
Highland Park is south of 6 Mile.
Got it. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So it's really quite central.
It's right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So forgive me for confusing the two. But I had the unique opportunity of having you here on a Sunday. We're recording, and I've long wanted to talk with you about the First Stop Shop, and it's an amazing project. And my big regret was that we weren't in the same place to do it, which is the thing that keeps coming up, right?
Yeah.
Great projects and not enough sort of critical mass to get the ball rolling in a place.
Well, it's been my great regret since I met you, Grace, is that we're not geographically in the same area because I think there's so many things we would be building together.
Yeah, yeah. So that aside for the moment, tell us a little bit about the First Stop Shop.
Well, it's part of a larger idea, First Stop Shop being one project under an umbrella of many worker-owned businesses, and I see the need for an umbrella organization doing that. Yeah. It's really hard to get new things going in small businesses, especially because there's so much business side of it involved. Mm-hmm. And under an umbrella organization, we could have an efficiency that a lot of the business part of it is handled. And the smaller entities plug into it and share the resources.
Right.
And a lot of times...
Right.
Rather than
like reinvent the wheel.
And do it over and over. And having been a business person, my ex-husband and I were food brokers in the natural foods industry. I know it takes a lot of time and certain skills to be doing all the paperwork involved in the business side of it.
All the accounting, all the accounts payable.
And I've seen and heard of some similar things going on here and there.
Mm-hmm.
So my elevator speech that I came up with for the first stop shop, which is mm-hmm. something I'm going to talk about, I named it this, I named it that, but these are just things where I gave it names and words just to have something as placeholders until the we came together to create it, and it was ours.
Right.
So the elevator speech is worker-owned enterprise using previously manufactured goods as our raw materials. And the name, the First Stop Shop, I assigned it that name because I was asking people to consider making this their first stop when they want to acquire goods.
Yeah. So don't go to the box store. And maybe you'll end up there. Maybe what you need isn't here. Yeah. But go to the First Stop Shop first and then see what you can find.
Yeah.
Right.
And it like everything, it's not for everybody, but I sense that it has the potential to be a successful endeavor because there's a lot of people whose values, stated values, are in line with what we'd be addressing through this enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of people looking for ways to live their values. I think one of the biggest pains for us, many of us, is feeling like our lives aren't in line with our values.
Oh, yeah.
And then feeling like some of the things that we're not, we don't think are for the betterment of our societies and our planet and our universe, that we're living in ways that contribute to the very thing we think is damaging.
Right.
So what is it I as an individual can do? Well, there's ultimately, I think, the most effective things are things that we will do collectively.
Right, right.
But something an I can do is be very careful about how we use our resources and using things from previously manufactured goods and
where the extraction's already happened.
Yeah, the extraction has already happened. And so we're not increasing the amount of things that also need to be disposed of, because this is an extractive, exploitative, damaging process from beginning to end.
Right.
And there is no real end.
Right.
The damage has lasting impact. And how we dispose of these things, as we know, for instance, plastics.
Yeah.
You know,
was it eight in times our the lifetimes, size of
Texas? We certainly won't see them, but it's estimated many lifetimes.
Right.
And very damaging. Have I lost track? Where am I?
So we were asking, what is the First Stop Shop? So, yeah, these raw materials are previously manufactured goods. And using that as your raw materials, air quotes, prevents further extraction, and on the tail end, prevents things from going just straight to the landfill that have more life in them.
Yeah, landfills, and we see those landfills disproportionately impact people that have the least power and least resources to protect themselves.
Right.
So it's extremely
damaging. The landfills and the incinerators are in... They're almost by definition in marginalized communities.
Yeah.
Right.
One of my favorite bumper sticker slogans, and I have this bumper sticker in my car right now, is when you throw something away, where is a way? There really is no way.
There just isn't.
And we've been putting it out of our sight, but that's becoming harder and harder to do.
Yeah.
China has recently banned, they're not interested in taking any more of our
trash. Right.
And some of these, you know, we look at it as like, oh, well, I can buy this and just give it away to a poor person who will benefit. But a lot of these countries are now refusing, for instance, textiles.
Right.
For a variety of reasons, including it's damaging
their own textile industries.
And that's just a part of the problem.
Like the tip of the iceberg
is
the damage to their textile industries. And for me, the thing that's really disheartening, or not not just disheartening, but
dismaying,
disgusting. I think I'm looking for disgusting.
Yeah,
is the way it eats away and corrodes their own culture.
Yes.
That, you know, you see these cute little Children of the World posters, and you see the little boy, the little German boy in his lederhosen, and you see the, like, the little Polish girl in her, like, intricately woven, or Ukrainian with this embroidery, and so on, right? So it, are children in Latin America and Africa actually dressed in, like, cast-off Nike? That's their traditional dress, is cast-off Nike clothing? And, or cast-off whatever that Americans threw away? That's not their traditional dress. That's not what they run around in. And it just really, it contributes to the erasure of these cultural identities. And that's that's disgusting.
And as I think of that, it may not even be the most appropriate attire for adapting to their environment.
Precisely. Precisely. So, yeah, in being as responsible as they see fit, they're saying, no, thank you. You can't send your trash here anymore.
And that's the simplest part of it. I think most of us, if we stop and think about it for even a short time, realize we have a serious overproduction problem. The volume of stuff in thrift shops and yard sales and flea markets.
It's out of control.
It's hard to give away and get anybody to even take it anymore.
Yeah,
because
there's just so much. And there's building after building after building of it. You know, I think there's a Goodwill in every city, a Salvation Army in every town. And they're basically these warehouses that are full, and they can't give it away, you know? So tell me a little bit where this project is. So you've been working on this for how long?
Well, I'm always looking at the most, from my limited vision, what is the upstream? Aware of problems and a lot of what we're called to, or what we see as activism, is dealing with the end results. Of these problems. And I'm looking, you know, isn't there something we can do before we get to that point that's going to be more effective? Because it just doesn't seem to be getting us anywhere. So I've been looking more upstream, and it seemed to me, as I did this analysis in so many different areas where I see we need to do things differently, that this was an upstream of many different things, whether it's environmental, justice issues, damaging the environment, like blowing mountaintops off. And the Child labor, destroying others' cultures and means to destabilizing their own systems that had been working.
Had been working, Oh, and let's not forget jobs with dignity.
Yeah.
I mean, many layers here,
And then at this end, living wage jobs, and that's why the worker-owned enterprise. We, one of the ways the Occupy movement was very successful is it's given us a common language and greater awareness of the disparity of resources. And we talk about the 1%, and we know what we're talking about. Well, this has all been a tool of that extraction of resources to the 1%, whether it's our labor. All of it.
Whatever it might be.
Yeah. So I know in Michigan, our municipalities have been robbed of the ability to, of local rule. Like, we cannot establish higher minimum wages than the state does. We can't have rent control.
So and to be clear, just to clarify a little bit. So let's say the city of Detroit wants to establish a higher local minimum wage. The state constitution forbids that.
Correct.
And let's say you want to have some kind of, so okay, maybe the state of Michigan
won't do
this.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's constitution, but it's, they've put it into some kind of law that municipalities cannot do. You can't ban plastic bags.
You can't ban plastic bags as a municipality.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to do it. So you know what? You're right. I'm glad you mentioned that. It's not constitutional. It is legislative. Mm-hmm. So we could potentially overturn it, mm-hmm. but that's the thing. It bars us from taking action in our local community, mm-hmm. and to make any change of that bar, we have to function at the state level, which for many people, unless you have the money to like physically mm-hmm. get to Lansing and lobby, mm-hmm. and unless you have the influence to get the ear mm-hmm. of folks in Lansing, you really, that's out of the loop for you.
Yeah, and it's going to take time and changing the system. And I hope there are people who are working on it and that they are effective. But I think we need to be looking at many different things going on
mm-hmm.
while we all stay connected.
This doesn't even include the emergency manager law, which is separate and distinct from
this. Yes, and Hamtramck, Highland Park, Detroit, mm-hmm. of course, Benton Harbor, Flint, many cities have been affected by these emergency managers, which is, that's a whole other outrageous thing that is...
It's just... appalling. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was Ypsilanti had an emergency school manager mm-hmm. that led to this disaster. We were talking about this earlier with their international school.
Yeah, in Highland Park, I'm not sure if it was the city or the school that mm-hmm. came first with the emergency manager. But,
And so Ypsilanti as a city is sort of in this shell shock mm-hmm. from the emergency manager for their public school system is now terrified of triggering an emergency manager for the city itself. And like everything they do, they're thinking, and that's why it's sort of ripe for mm-hmm. these scandals that you see. People are terrified of triggering the emergency manager because we saw how it played out mm-hmm. in other places. We saw how it played out in the school system. And it's a disaster.
Yeah, so I don't know that they cannot also pass legislation that would eliminate or hamper our ability to do worker-owned collectives, but it's something that's available to us now.
Right now, that can happen in Michigan. We have cooperatives, we have cooperative housing. Mm-hmm. There's a legal infrastructure. It's mm-hmm. a bit, what's the word I'm looking for? It's kind of cobbled together mm-hmm. because unlike many states, we don't have any law. It's like you can form a corporation under Michigan state law. Mm-hmm. You can't form a cooperative under Michigan state law. You can form a corporation and then mm-hmm. call it a cooperative in your bylaws. Mm-hmm. And that's the most we have. But it exists and we can use it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And we have people doing it that we can tap into those resources to learn the best ways to deal with the system as it is.
So... So we started it off with the ways in which Michigan, by law, prevents municipalities from taking local mm-hmm. action. And so you were getting at how this is something we can do.
Yeah.
We can form cooperatives.
And in narrowing down my passion and my work so I can mm-hmm. be somewhat effective, where I do... put pressure on my legislators mm-hmm. in relationship to this is, first of all, showing them cities that are doing things to encourage this kind of thing and where it's successful and how it can benefit the cities mm-hmm. in ways that the current model doesn't, and asking for a more level playing field because we are underwriting and incentivizing these I'm just going to use the language that Grace and I are comfortable with and understand what it means, capitalist, unbridled capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, say the Illiches and the Dan Gilberts of Detroit are those projects that they benefit greatly from mm-hmm. are underwritten by the people of Detroit through the incentives.
Right.
You know, valuable properties being given over for $1 so they can build stadiums that they will make money at.
Right. So they're going to make money, but the people of Detroit are going to pay for it.
So one of the things that's most infuriating to me is when I see an article that was ostensibly saying, co-ops, great idea. And then the conclusion of the author of this one that comes to mind is saying, but if it's such a great idea, why haven't there been more of them and why aren't they more successful? It's because we don't have a level playing ground. They have not been.
It's like credit unions that we don't have a level playing ground.
Yes. So I will and do put pressure on my legislators
to make it more level.
Yeah, realize that this is a benefit for our areas mm-hmm. and that it needs to be given a chance by being incentivized. And there's places like Madison, Wisconsin and New mm-hmm. York City that mm-hmm. are doing this.
Yeah.
They realize that this is something that's going to benefit their city. It's a way they can get around some of the handcuffs that were put on by the states and federal mm-hmm. limitations put on us. The money stays more locally.
Yes. It's an all-around win. Even mm-hmm. for capitalists, mm-hmm. it's a win. Except what I think a lot of capitalists don't like to admit about themselves is they like capitalism for them. Mm-hmm. Right? Or like rather, they like socialism for them and capitalism for the rest of us, yeah. right? Or that's one way I've heard it put. But they really like it when they're the only capitalist in town and they run mm-hmm. the show. Mm-hmm. They don't actually like free competition because that means effectively you have to share.
Yeah, and that stems from something that I know you and I share, Grace, is mm-hmm. The only way I can understand that is that people that favor that type of capitalism or economic model mm-hmm. don't see the connection that ultimately right. they cannot continue benefiting and certainly yeah. future generations. So if they do care about their children yeah. and their grandchildren, they're harming them.
Yeah, this is an act of harm to your grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about or touching on this earlier. When we were talking about like monarchy and hierarchy and so on mm-hmm. that, there used to be a disposition of understanding that if I create this harm in the long term, it's only going to come back to bite me. Mm-hmm. And we took a lot of those checks out of the system. So people can actually kind of convince themselves that making $1 billion today at everyone's expense is somehow better than making $1 million over the next 10 years and maybe doing things a little more equitably, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Because honestly, I think in the world we've come into, first of all, back up all the way, I'm talking about making this money or making that money. I seem to remind people that money is not real. You can't mm-hmm. eat it. But let's just pretend that money is a thing. Because the shared delusion
like
of money.
Like we do.
We have this shared delusion. Uh-huh. We print it every time, and the shared delusion has real impacts on our lives. Mm-hmm. So let's pretend money is a thing, and you need to make it. We're not talking about saying these billionaires don't have nice homes anymore. We're talking about no children starving. The people with nice mm-hmm. things will still have nice things, mm-hmm. right? We're talking about children not starving. And I think that's the reality that a lot of people don't grasp, that the orders of magnitude, the billions and trillions of dollars that individuals have, is enough money for that individual to be just as comfortable as they are right now. Give the rest of it away, mm-hmm. and children don't starve. Elderly people don't wonder where their next meal is coming from.
Yeah, because these resources that they've hoarded mm-hmm. Aren't being utilized anyway.
They're not being used.
You can only use so much.
Right. You can only eat so well. You can only live in so many houses at the same time. And beyond that, you're just hoarding. And that hoarding harms people. So this is kind of really just about stopping the hoarding, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think what's really genius about this umbrella of worker-owned cooperatives is it takes effectively the system's waste mm-hmm. and diverts the system's exploitation into meaningful jobs mm-hmm. and our actual needs being met. I need a new coat. So we're going to divert some of the waste. We're going to meet the needs of people who have needs and jobs and in the career mm-hmm. and then give someone the coat that they need. Mm-hmm. And rather than find some new social benefit method, you know, corporation where you go to an impoverished village and turn it into making coats for I don't know who and I don't know how. and using more extractive technology on the same model. It kind of, it basically subverts the system. That's what's always made me giddy, is the way that this subverts the system and kind of effectively uses the system against itself.
Well, the Facebook group I set up for this, it's First Stop Shop.
Right.
Boycott the system. So I use it as a massive boycott because these short-term boycotts are token.
Yeah. Well, no, like right now we're supposed to be boycotting Nestle. You know, I've been boycotting Nestle for more than 30 years.
Yes.
They're still doing it.
Yeah.
You know? So, like, this massive boycott of the system is kind of the only way to see how we can get our material needs met, sort of diverting things from the system to make it happen. So what are the barriers you faced here to getting forward, moving forward and getting it off the ground?
Number one is people.
People.
It's not an I, it's a we. And I've had, at least in the earlier stages, people saying, great idea, but not people willing to step out of their current lives and let's do it.
Let's do it, yeah. Come on.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And when I say early stages, I think it's that I haven't enlarged my circle enough that I have new ears to hear what I have to say. And people are tired of hearing the same old tune from me.
Which happens.
Yeah, so I've exhausted that.
You keep playing your record, you know?
Yeah. So, why keep talking about it at all? Well, I kind of can't not. It's can't in not. Me. And I still hope to plant some seeds. I am in the process, I hope, of dispersing. I took it beyond words and telling people because I think people couldn't get it. And I thought that if I build it, they will come.
Right, right.
And I did get what seemed to me like a significant level of encouragement for it. I'm not a person that can continue to carry it. I don't have the resources that I can maintain
just keep it going
life for myself, let alone that. That I've planted enough seeds that'll take
root
somewhere sometime. Yeah. The frustration is, if not now, when?
Man.
Do we wait?
I mean, how desperate do we have to be
to
take this off the ground?
Right? I got clear in my life 15-some years ago now that my role in this was building a new model. You know, there's people who were tearing down the old unjust ways. We need to have some things that we're building in the meantime. And I really like the Buckminster Fuller quote. You don't change things by eliminating the old model. You build a new model that makes the old model obsolete.
Obsolete, yeah.
And so I try to do that. And it's not new with me. I didn't invent these ideas. I may hone it, put it together in a different way, see that if many of us are doing this, we're building a web of a new way. And there's places where they do repair cafes.
Yeah, I love this.
There's, I think, in the Netherlands, a whole mall of businesses that are repurposed goods.
Right.
And whether it's just cleaning up a wonderful functional item and showing people how it's useful, or taking it apart, smelting it down. I mean, we do that with metal, and possible to do it with glass and some things. One of the impediments to that kind of thing is we've been told it's cheaper to replace it than to fix it. But we're looking at a very small piece. The bigger picture is it is not cheaper. It's costing. And we have been sold a bill of goods about free and cheap. But our free and our inexpensive is paid for by somebody else. And also cheap manifests in very poor quality goods mm-hmm. that don't last.
Right.
And one of the reasons some of these previously manufactured goods, one should covet them, mm-hmm. is that many things were made of a higher quality at a time when corporations didn't insist on such high return every single quarter.
Every quarter. Right.
And people hadn't become addicted to having large volumes of very inexpensive stuff.
Large volumes of inexpensive stuff and new every season.
Yes.
So it's fall,
time for new
clothes.
That's been around for a while, though. And the auto industry and the fashion industry
have
been big contributors to our believing that.
Right.
Very damaging.
It's beyond planned obsolescence mm-hmm. into this sensation that your coat, your shoes, your car, mm-hmm. it all needs to be new. Like, it has to be the appropriate style. It has to be and look new and not mm-hmm. worn in any way. Whereas, like, you know, my favorite shoes are well worn. My favorite coat is well worn, right? But no. We don't do that. We don't play that.
And one of the impediments to mm-hmm. what you were asking about that is that we have a culture that doesn't appreciate old people, old wisdom.
Yes.
There's a patina and a beauty, you know, that there's the Japanese term wabi-sabi. Mm-hmm. It's become kind of trendy too. But it's an appreciation for how things age. And, you know, we mm-hmm. have this, some people are aware of a pottery technique mm-hmm. where broken pottery is put together mm-hmm. with gold. So it has gold veins. And
it highlights the quote damage.
Yes.
As part of its beauty. Yeah.
So it may require us to create a new sensibility, a new taste for something. Mm-hmm. You know, things are an acquired taste. Well, guess what? We were told that this mm-hmm. is what's beautiful, just like we talk about the white features being beautiful versus other cultures.
Yeah.
This is all acquired. We can, if we really understand and the cost of the tastes we've allowed ourselves to acquire, mm-hmm. we can redirect that.
Right. I mean, and especially the people who claim to value doing so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's folks who, you know, they like their suburban tract house. Mm. They like the way it looks. They like it. They don't have any value conflict for themselves. I'm actually not talking to them.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I don't care for them or think someone needs to talk to them. I think there's a different conversation to have with them.
Mm-hmm.
But for the folks who seem to express this as a value,
mm-hmm.
I think that means you need to do something different. And
although I think there's people living in those places that share these values too. You know,
there's
pros and cons, and there's reasons.
Reasons are there.
Suburban layout mm-hmm. is appealing
right.
to some people.
No, I have lived in the city my entire life. I've always lived with a sidewalk and a city garden. Mm-hmm. And this is actually the first time in my adult life I've been further than walking distance from church.
Mm.
Very first time. I've always lived within blocks of mm-hmm. our church. And the decision to move here was driven by some things that weren't necessarily internal. Right? So here I am in a place I wouldn't normally. So I don't mean to shame people for mm-hmm. living where they live and doing what they do exactly. Mm-hmm. But there are folks whose values are not aligned with what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's okay. That's a different conversation.
Yeah. And that's been a pushback. Well, people won't. Well, some people won't. Some people will. We have to start somewhere.
With the people who
somehow.
Want this, right? Who claim to want this.
Yeah. And one of the current trends that I'm not sure. Dismay isn't quite the word. Mm-hmm. Actually, it kind of pisses me off. Is this simplicity mm-hmm. movement?
Oh, yes.
Which is...
which I...
honestly, is more of an aesthetic thing. And
than
so people are going to throw away their functional things and go out and buy new, often poor quality things so they can have this look of simplicity. And then we're guilted into, you know, mm-hmm. told that, well, clutter makes you depressed and stuff, and this is lack of clutter.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's an in-between, and you're talking about I, not mm-hmm. we, and the impact on other people. Because I do believe that people of privilege have greatly benefited from this system that is. So people mm-hmm. of privilege, whatever your level of privilege is, mm-hmm. have a greater responsibility to deal with the consequences
right,
of it.
Right.
And I don't think it's going to be all painful. You know, there's an adjustment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But no, this idea that this simplistic or minimalist mm-hmm. aesthetic is somehow ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, it's an aesthetic. Mm-hmm. Simplicity, you know, simplicity's been around a long time. Who was it? I'm going to forget who to attribute the quote to. You know, you need to live simply so that others can simply live.
Mm-hmm.
That's been with us a very long time.
And long enough that we didn't have the obscene abundance of stuff we have now.
Right.
Somehow, right. Not that we haven't been overproducing for some time now, but it really ramped up. I haven't done the numbers to see when and where and
when
how.
It took off. But yeah.
But it's a different thing. And one of the things that got things a little clearer has influenced my thinking was a essay by Joan Chittister, which was published mm-hmm. in her book, The Heart of the Temple, on simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about this being a complex world, so wanting simplicity isn't necessarily realistic.
Yeah.
And oftentimes when we strive for this simplicity, whether it's in relationships where we just say, I don't want anything to do with conflict, I'm not going to clutter my life with conflict, or whether it's stuff.
Or politics.
We're oftentimes pushing that off on other people. And
right.
that's privilege that allows you to do it.
Right.
So when you get rid of the stuff, who's bearing the cost?
The cost of
you getting
rid of it.
And some of the principles behind it, you know, in KonMari, well, if it doesn't bring you joy, again, this is a very I keep hearing the I.
Right.
But well, if you can replace it for no more than $20, I don't know what their number is.
Mm-hmm.
Heck with it, you know that you can replace it. Well, not everybody can, number one. And you're still contributing to that consumer.
Consumerism.
Excess consumption and production mm-hmm. model. And not everybody has, you know, say, so I'm going to share. And I've tried setting up sharing networks, which is something I do support.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're going to do that well, too, we need to make sure that we're all bearing the burden of it. You know, people don't mind borrowing things from me, but they also don't mind criticizing me for having so much stuff. Something's not fitting here.
Yeah,
you know,
I
want, you know, at some point to have smaller houses, but have a large community house where the shared things are, which is built into some co-housing things.
Yeah.
But we need to find ways to do this.
That everyone has access to.
Yes.
Because that's the co-housing problem.
It's
a playground for rich white people.
Right, yes.
You know? And that doesn't solve the problem.
Yeah. So we can, you know, co-housing's interesting to look at, but and it's stolen or taken its cues from the way community, some of the things community used to be,
right.
and put them in another model.
In another gated community model.
Yeah.
Right.
It's
and the
not
gate
accessible
is
to all.
The gate is money.
So increasing the commons, libraries, and there are libraries that are lending more than just books,
right,
but using
right.
the library model
mm-hmm.
that we all contribute to
mm-hmm.
and we can all
benefit
share.
From.
Yeah.
So, and then that's the thing. When there's an individual who takes on this community role and provides a cooperative common space
mm-hmm.
of stuff and things and resources,
mm-hmm.
it becomes like, huh, why do you have all this stuff? Huh, what are you doing? That's not very, you know, minimalist or whatever the aesthetic of the
mm-hmm.
moment is.
Yeah.
And to be clear, I sort of embrace a minimalist aesthetic. It's something
I love
like,
it.
Yeah, I like it. I like the aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
But this thing as like a cultural movement is perverse, you know? And
I actually, at this point, because I've mm-hmm. been carrying this and I'm not the healthiest mindset about it right now, mm-hmm. resent having to carry
so much of this. Right, right. And then it turns into, oh, look at you not being minimalist. But didn't you also just get something out of her not being a minimalist? I'm just asking, right? People benefit.
Mm-hmm.
There are things at the First Stop Shop that people want to buy and they can get them there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's only possible because you've made that possible, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, it's been underwritten by me.
Underwritten by you. And similarly,
in a big way.
They don't say, well, what's up with JCPenney hoarding all this stuff? No one says that.
Yeah.
Why do they have this weird? They understand what's going on,
mm-hmm.
that they want those items, and this is a place where they can go get them, and they go get them there, right? I think people really have a lot of the system trains us to view corporations as good and individuals mm-hmm. and collective action as bad, and to be suspicious of it and to criticize it because it is that.
Yeah, and it,
right.
I've found it really interesting these last couple of years in the pharmaceutical industry world.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the fellow that did the EpiPen?
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah. I don't remember his name, but he's a kind of a smarmy guy.
Yeah. So we have one person and we can pin it on and we hate him. Why are we not saying it about the corporations that do the same thing?
Yeah. Curious that this individual is a bad guy.
Yeah.
We're not talking about how the pharmaceutical industry is grotesque.
Yeah.
And does a lot of harm as an industry.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a conversation we're willing to have, but we're willing to excoriate this guy. Mm-hmm. And really, he's kind of a smarmy guy.
Yeah. He's easy to dislike.
He's easy to dislike, but we're going to excoriate him, but never evaluate the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
Not in any critical way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always just kind of mysterious to me. Like you don't see how those connected, but we don't sometimes. We really don't.
Mm-hmm.
So moving forward. So like, what do you see going forward? What's in the, where do you want to take this going from here?
Well, like I said, I hope it takes root somewhere, somehow, and I'm sure it is.
Yeah.
I don't think this is unique. And I'm just, at this point in my life, kind of sadly burnt out on it and needing to move on and see mm-hmm. what next.
What next?
Going through the very laborious and I anticipate painful process of dispersing these goods and hoping they don't wind up in landfills. And,
right.
One of the roots of this, and I realize how it's deep in me and not just this thing, is I like to see things well used.
Yes.
In the best sense of the word.
Right, best sense of well used. Right.
And that's people and our gifts,
mm-hmm.
goods, mm-hmm. And they're intertwined too.
Right.
We are not using people's gifts well by continuing to extract unnecessary labor to create more unnecessary goods when we have a lot of goods out.
We have a lot of goods. And really the only reason we're doing that is to extract wealth to send in one direction.
Yes, it's been this is how they created a system that could extract wealth. And
then pump it towards the wealthiest people.
Yes.
People who are already mm-hmm. wealthy.
Yeah, and if you want to, you know, people come up with almost ridiculous arguments to right. it, you know, well, you know, if co-ops were so great, why aren't there more of them?
Well, we have legislation preventing that.
Yeah.
and well, poor people are better off now than they were 100 years ago. Oh, really?
Well,
a microwave, is
it? One of those ridiculous, in my view, arguments was, well, what when we run out of stuff? You know, we're a long ways and we'll just deal with it.
We'll just deal with it.
I mean, that's ideally what life is. We're changing and
adapting.
In the software development, they have the terms agile and mm-hmm. lean, which mm-hmm. mean it's just kind of common sense. Yeah. You look at it as you go. You do it simple to start with. You tweak it as you go along,
right.
and you deal with things as they come, you know.
But that's marvelous, though. What are you going to do when you run out of stuff? Well...
Well, I see us applying a just-in-time model, which they've done in manufacturing, where instead of backlogging all the parts, mm-hmm. we fine-tune our system so we are only ordering and manufacturing the parts to things as we need them, and to try to predict what we're going to need in the future. in a fast-changing world is kind of ridiculous anyway.
And I'm also hoping, I'm really hoping that one of the things that grows from this, these planted seeds, is something that shifts our full understanding of what it is we actually need, right?
Yes.
That you don't need some new dealy bopper from the dollar store. You actually don't need that. But, you know, your washing machine has a broken part. Yeah, maybe you need that. Mm-hmm. Maybe you don't. Yeah, maybe you don't. Maybe, and I use a washing machine, full disclosure, I use a washing machine and a dryer. Many days of the year, I've got my drying rack, but I don't use it on in ice storms. But maybe you don't need that washer. Maybe you do. Maybe you need something with more appropriate technology. So I'd like to see our technology and our manufactured goods go the route of needed and wanted items rather than items looking for someone to buy them.
Yes.
Because right now we have a whole economy of problems looking, or probably solutions looking for problems and goods looking for someone to buy them.
Yes.
Rather than people looking for goods and people solving their own problems.
Yeah. And culture shifting is a big part of this.
Yeah.
Just to create an understanding of why you should be inconvenienced, because right now it's going to seem inconvenient as it gets going, because it's more convenient to have a 24-hour Meijer and go there whatever you want and have things displayed.
Lined up on the shelves.
But one of the things about these being small co-op entities that are fully transparent is we start to really understand everything that goes into it, and we can start questioning, how can Meijer pay these bills for the lights and the shelves and the staff
and stuff.
And me still get this thing for dirt cheap?
At 3 a.m.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
So we start connecting more with the reality of this system that we've created that just can't keep going on this way.
Can't.
Not if we want to reduce rather than increase the suffering in the world.
Yeah.
As we have the ability to have the information about what's happening, it's not hidden to us. How many of us aren't in pain from coming to the greater and greater realization of we come to at some point get to the real understanding that I have somehow participated in this.
Yes. But I've done
I'm
this.
Complicit or I'm participating in it. How and I do feel, I not participate?
I'd rather not participate. And I feel like some of these like arguments, so, what are you going to do when you run out of stuff, is some people's answer to that cognitive dissonance where they're like, I've been a part of this. It's much more important to point out why nothing else was possible rather than embrace that they've been a part of something really destructive. And yeah, I mean, it's painful to embrace that, but I think that's the first step to doing something different, you know? So, any last thoughts?
I wish everyone well, and I hope that you're on the journey to greater love and openness and acceptance and belief that it can be different and that we are, we have a role in the change that can, that is possible.
It's possible. Yeah. Amen. All right. I think Paul's probably going to read an outro, and I think that'll be a wrap.
Okay. Thank you, Grace.
Thanks, Joy. All righty. Take care.
You've been listening to the Grace and Paul Podcast. Check out the show blog at podcast.blogspot.com, where you can leave comments or search for the Grace and Paul Podcast on Facebook or YouTube.